Hello and welcome to the magazine rack on Chris. I'm Mario Kahar, and today I'll be reading from the April 2024 issue of Sports Illustrated magazine and from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. First up, we have an article by Tom Verducci titled, Honoring Hank Aaron's 715th Home Run and the 10 Most Important Home Runs Ever Hit. 50 years ago this month, Hank Aaron made history, and Vin Scully perfectly curated it in real time. Here's the call.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
Aaron didn't just break the all-time home run record held by Babe Ruth, the most iconic record in all of sports, but with incredible perseverance, he also survived the racist hate that for more than a year made him feel, as he put it, like a pig in a slaughterhouse. Scully, the broadcasting equal to the home run king, rose to the moment with these words.
What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol. And it is a great moment for all of us, and particularly for Henry Aaron, who was met at home plate not only by every member of the Braves, but by his father and mother.
Without social contact, sport is glorified intramural. Somebody wins, somebody loses. Only when sport connects people, whether through the tethers of civic pride, inspiration, aspiration, social justice, or simple awe and wonder, do our games truly matter. And that's why I believe Aaron's 715th home run is the most important home run ever hit. It didn't win a championship. It was bigger. So in choosing my 10 most important home runs ever hit, I looked beyond the score. Yeah, history matters. The most important baseball moments do change history. But I also want cultural significance, the home runs that get so embedded in the fabric of America that they resonate with even a non-baseball fan. And I want authenticity. It's not too much to ask that the most important home runs are achieved legitimately, which is why you won't see any performance-enhancing drug-fueled home runs on my list. So first on the list, Hank Aaron career home run number 715, 1974. Aaron received hundreds of letters in 1973 filled with racial insults and death threats that had to be vetted by the FBI. He left ballparks by back exits. He needed police escorts. His children lived under kidnap threats. The grueling chase ended with number 715 against Dodgers pitcher Al Downing at 9:07 on Monday night, April 8, 1974 in Atlanta, 50 years ago. 35 million people watched on television. President Richard Nixon, who 22 days later would give a televised address about the Watergate scandal, immediately placed a phone call to congratulate Aaron. Shamefully, MLB Commissioner Bowie Kuhn wasn't there. He skipped the historic event to speak at a private event in Cleveland. When Aaron was asked to address the crowd, the first thing that came out of his mouth was, "Thank God it's over." He spent that night at home with friends and family. They stayed up chatting until 4 a.m. Hank finally went to bed at 6. By the time Hank reported to the stadium for the next game, he was exhausted. "Just tired. All I felt was tired and relieved," he said when asked how he felt. "The average person doesn't realize what a nightmare this has been. The same questions every day, and the controversy." Number two on the list, Kirk Gibson, 1988 World Series Game 1. It happened during the peak of baseball's popularity, with all the images and backstory to make it an indelible part of American culture. It's the epitome of why we love sports, and baseball in particular. a stunning moment out of nowhere in a game in which you cannot run out the clock. And how about this cast? Dennis Eckersley on the mound, Tony La Russa and Tommy Lasorda in the dugout, and Scully, Joe Garagiola, Bob Costas, and Marv Albert on the NBC TV broadcast, and Jack Buck and Bill White on CBS Radio. Number 3. Carlton Fisk, 1975 World Series Game 6. 3 days of rain forced Kuhn to make a gamble, schedule a weeknight World Series game at 8:30 p.m., smack in the family viewing hour of network television. Sports television changed that night. As I wrote in 2015 about the most influential baseball broadcast ever, and I quote, "Think about what we now take for granted in televised sports. Primetime starts, the networks influencing when games are played, cameras placed at unusual vantage points, reaction shots of athletes away from the ball. All of it can be traced to the NBC telecast of Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. What the 1958 NFL title game did for pro football, Game 6 did for televised sports. There is only before and after." Number 4. Babe Ruth, 1932 World Series Game 3. It doesn't matter if you believe the Babe called his shot or not. Now, he did point toward the center field bleachers, and then he did smack a home run there, estimated at 450 feet. It's the legacy that matters. It's the Babe at Wrigley Field in the World Series. It's the origin to anybody in any sport calling their shot. Number 5. Ted Williams, last at bat, home run, September 28, 1960. Why include a home run in a meaningless game with only 10,454 people at Fenway Park? Well, one of the people at Fenway that day was John Updike. His subsequent essay, "Hub Fans Bid Kid Adieu," is one of the finest American essays of the 20th century. It began, "Fenway Park in Boston is a lyric little bandbox of a ballpark." It continued to sing from there. When the crowd wanted Williams to take a bow after he hit a home run in his final at-bat, Updike wrote of Williams' refusal, "Gods do not answer letters." Number 6. Bill Mazeroski, 1960 World Series Game 7. The quintessential boyhood dream, a home run in the bottom of the ninth to win a World Series Game 7. The moment was made greater because it was Mazeroski, batting eighth in the Pittsburgh lineup, who ended a 10-9 game in which not one strikeout was recorded. Number 7. Joe Carter, 1993 World Series Game 6. It wasn't a Game 7, but there was the one time a World Series ended on a home run when the team was trailing. Toronto trailed Philadelphia 6-5. When Carter connected off Mitch Williams with two future Hall of Famers on base, Ricky Henderson and Paul Molitor. Number 8. David Ortiz, 2004 ALCS Game 4. The stolen base by Dave Roberts made it possible for the Red Sox to tie the game, averting, for the moment, a four-game sweep to the Yankees. It was Ortiz's home run in the 12th that delivered the win, setting in motion the greatest postseason comeback in sports history and the curse generations of New Englanders had endured. Number 9. Derek Jeter, 1996 ALCS Game 1. When the Orioles left Yankee Stadium after Game 2, many of them were carping that they should have been going home up 2-0. Instead, 5 outs from a win in Game 1, they watched Jeter flip a fly ball to right field that Tony Tarasco was about to catch when a fan, Jeffrey Meyer, deflected it with his glove into the stands for a tying home run. The moment was the start to the only true dynasty of the free agent era. From 1996 to 2000, the Yankees won 4 of 5 World Series while going 21-8 at home in the postseason. And finally, number 10, Bobby Thompson, 1951 tiebreaker game. The shot heard round the world is a legend boosted by a particular time and place, when baseball and publishing were such heavily New York-centered pursuits. The revelation of the Giants' second-half sign-stealing scheme significantly weakens the drama and the import of their comeback against the Dodgers. And some honorable mention, Aaron Judge home run number 62 in 2022. Roger Maris home run number 61 in 1961. Bucky Dent home run in 1978 tiebreaker game. And Kirby Puckett home run in 1991 World Series Game 6. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Up next is an article by Kristen Nelson titled, Despite Title Game Loss, Caitlin Clark's Legacy is Indisputable. Before Iowa took on the South Carolina Gamecocks in the Women's National Championship game last Sunday, Clark was asked a lot about her legacy. In the grand scheme, she said winning a championship was not vital to cement her place as one of the best college basketball players of all time. She didn't want her 4 years in Iowa City to come down to just a couple of games. She wanted it to be about the people she inspired and the way she carried herself. Now, that didn't mean she didn't want to win. It's really hard to win these things. I think I probably know that better than most people by now, said Clark, after the Hawkeyes' 87-75 loss to the Gamecocks last Sunday. To be so close twice, it definitely hurts, but at the same time, we were right there. We battled. We took down some really great teams to get back to this point, and it's something that's really hard to do. In the first quarter, it seemed like Clark may be on her way to getting that title. She racked up 18 points, 11 of them coming in a span of about 1 minute. Clark wasn't going to let this game finish without making her mark on it, tying her points total from the UConn Final Four game in the first half with 21 and finishing with 30. But her mark was made long before tip-off. Thousands of Iowa fans flocked to Cleveland that weekend, contributing to sellouts on both game days and filling the stands with number 22 jerseys. Every time Clark touched the ball, the crowd was loud. I mean, I'm talking the you think your ears are bleeding kind of loud that happens when 18,000 people scream in unison indoors while one of Clark's patented threes falls. The noise was mind-numbing for everyone except the players. Clark and her teammates claimed all weekend they never really noticed it until the games were over. And even then, a different kind of noise takes place. All of the commentary on whether Clark is overrated, if the officials are favoring her, and debating if she's worthy of GOAT status. She didn't seem to let that noise affect her either. Somehow, even just moments removed from losing in the national title game for the second straight year, Clark seemed to be filled with more gratitude than defeat. And as the spotlight has shone on her with unmatched intensity over the last year, her maturity has been essential to the way she's carried herself, not only during countless interviews, but on the court as well. I think Caitlin Clark handled the pressure and weight so much better than I think she got credit for, and she gets credited for a lot, said Iowa assistant head coach Jan Jensen. I don't get on social media a lot, but I feel like I got my ire up a few times when they would be really on her. Didn't think she was that good, didn't have a national title, but that kid delivered every night. I don't know if we'll ever see anyone like her for a long time. Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said managing those emotions has not always been Clark's strength. When she first started as a Hawkeye, it was all fire and no love. Her perfectionism would get in the way, and that fire was not always communicated well with her teammates. Learning to control her passion is what has turned her into a leader, one that brought her team to back-to-back title games. I definitely think that's the biggest way I've matured and grown over the course of my 4 years, is just to never get rattled by things that don't go your way, said Clark. Basketball isn't a perfect game. That's what's going to happen. And that's honestly what I'm the most proud of. Even without being perfect, Clark rewrote numerous records this year. She finished with the most points, 3,951, in Division I basketball history, men's or women's. She's the only woman in Division I to have more than 3,000 points and 1,000 assists, finishing with 1,144 assists. Her 548 three-pointers are another D1 record, and this season's 201 threes and 1,234 points are single-season Division I records. Now that the ink has officially dried on those records, it's time to wipe them clean for the next step in Clark's career. While her college points total won't matter as a pro, what many in the WNBA are hoping she can bring with her are eyeballs to the tube. ESPN broke viewership records one game after another as Iowa progressed in the tournament. The fact that there won't be a ton of downtime until people can see Clark play again could be the key to that. Unlike a lot of other leagues, the turnaround from college to pro is incredibly quick for women's basketball players. Clark played in the title game on April 7th, the WNBA draft, where she is a presumed number one pick for the Indiana Fever, is April 15th. Training camps start April 28th, and the regular season begins on May 14th. And let's not forget a possible midsummer trip to Paris, as Clark was invited to USA Basketball's Olympic training camp from April 3rd through the 5th, although she was a bit busy at that time. After Iowa outdueled UConn in the Final Four, Mercury Phoenix veteran Diana Taurasi gave a rather blunt warning of what's awaiting Clark in the pros. And I quote, "Reality is coming. You look superhuman playing against 18-year-olds, but here you're going to come play with some grown women that have been playing professional basketball for a long time," Taurasi said on ESPN. "I'm not saying that's not going to translate, because when you're good at what you do, you're just going to get better. But there is going to be a transition period where you're going to have to give yourself some grace as a rookie. Iowa fans likely aren't ready for this era to end, Bluter especially. Can she still change her mind? Is that possible?" the coach joked. "I don't know. I would like that very much." And regardless of what you personally think of her, her impact on the sport is undeniable. "I'd like to think the biggest impact was that a lot of people got inspired, young, old, men and women," said Jensen. "Probably some cats and dogs out there, too. You never know. I feel like I've seen some dogs wearing Caitlin number 22 jerseys." But for now, the book of Caitlin Clark's collegiate career, one that is bound to be referenced for many years to come, is over. Thankfully for us, the sequel will begin in just a week's time. You're tuned in to the magazine Rack on Chris. The next article is by Bob Harrig, titled "Akshay Bhatia Running on Adrenaline Comes Full Circle with Masters Invitation." As the last man in the Masters field, Akshay Bhatia had to do some scrambling last Sunday night. Actually, it was his team that did the legwork. They secured a rental house and arrangement for private airplane transportation and got him the necessary credentials to arrive at Augusta National for the first time as a tournament participant last Monday afternoon. Bhatia, 22, didn't get to Augusta until after 1:30 a.m. on Monday, a celebratory journey that left him exhausted and sleeping in. Hey, who could blame him? Bhatia's playoff victory on Sunday over Denny McCarthy at the Valero Texas Open got him the last spot in the 89-player field, and one he'd not have earned without that victory. Now he's back at the place where he first came 10 years ago as a kid playing in Augusta's National Drive Chip and Putt event. "I slept in as much as I could," Bhatia said less than an hour after arriving at the club on Monday. "I didn't get much sleep. Still, a lot of adrenaline. Then I got here. Just kind of got the lay of the land of Augusta. I haven't been here in a couple years, and I truly haven't seen it as a tournament. It's pretty cool. There's a lot going on for sure, and I'm still learning a bunch." After his drive, chip, and putt appearance a decade ago, Bhatia returned one other time. In the fall of 2019, he was invited by a member to play the course. As great as that experience was, it's far different from playing the course during tournament week, for which he will need a quick learning curve to get ready for Thursday's first round. Not that he's all that worried. I think soaking in what just happened is important, said Bhatia, who turned pro at 17, skipped college, and won last year at the Barracuda Championship, a tournament that doesn't come with a Masters invite. You don't get to kind of have those opportunities too much. I waited 7-8 months to kind of get those feelings of singing in the car on the way to the airport and just kind of bouncing up and down on the plane ride. Today I'm still going to soak it in. Tomorrow is kind of, okay, what's our goals for the week, and just get ready to tee it up. So it's another golf tournament. It's a very special tournament. But at the end of the day, one of us is going to win. So that's kind of my goal, and I'm excited to tee it up. Bhatia led wire to wire in San Antonio, which is a bit of a misnomer when you consider that he had a 6-shot lead with 9 holes to play and saw McCarthy, already in the Masters field, make putts from everywhere, eventually tying him. In fact, Bhatia needed to make a lengthy putt of his own on the 18th green to force a playoff, and then saw McCarthy knock his approach in the water on the same hole, opening the door. But even that was not without drama, as Bhatia, who plays left-handed, injured his left shoulder and needed treatment between shots. He said Monday he's dealing with a shoulder issue for some time, and it flared up as he celebrated the tournament tying putt a few moments later. So, along with everything else, he's having to make sure it gets treated this week in addition to preparing for a demanding golf course. And, Bhatia said, he had yet to really wrap his arms around all that occurred in 24 hours. I really can't, he said. Just wire to wire is very hard to do. Having a 6-shot lead with 9 holes to go, you feel pretty good about yourself. I was playing really good all day, and Denny just kind of found this fire in him. And when a guy shoots 28 on the back, makes, I think he had 7 1 putts on the back 9, it's pretty impressive. Just to be standing here is amazing, and just having the opportunity, the members giving us the opportunity to play their golf course is certainly special, and I can't wait to be on that first tee on Thursday. You are listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Next up is a piece by Mark Bechtel titled Fresh Air. Harvey Martin is aware of the irony. The Giants' human performance coach saw his own baseball career end in the minors due to a case of the yips. The pitcher, who had 91 strikeouts and 7 walks in his last college season, suddenly just couldn't find the zone. In a roundabout way, though, his loss of confidence led him to the big leagues in one of the game's most interesting roles, breathing specialist. Martin, who says he's always been a bit of an intellectual, started meditating when he was in college. He later took up a sports psychology class while in grad school at Minnesota State. After the Brewers released him in 2015, Martin started to use those tools to work on his anxiety. He added Wim Hof breathing techniques and cold water therapy. "I would just go cut a hole in the ice and sit in the water," he says. Martin, who earned a master's in sports performance, began to delve deeper into the role breathing played in physiology. Unlike, let's say, changing one's heart rate, a person can control how and how often they inhale and exhale. Breathing's the only thing that we can really take conscious control of among those uncontrollables in our body, says Martin, who was coaching high school kids at the time to pay his bills. And that's when it flipped. I wanted to obviously alleviate my own symptoms of anxiety and depression first. And then, I was a baseball guy, so I wanted to bring it into Major League Baseball. Through networking and word of mouth, he began working with athletes in Minnesota, gradually making his way up the food chain. In 2021, a friend introduced him to then San Francisco manager Gabe Kapler, who brought Martin on staff under Dave Greshner, the team's senior director of athletic training. It's no surprise that Kapler, an outside-the-box thinker, would buy into something that sounds a bit new-agey, but Martin rarely encountered resistance from players either. Martin does most of his work before and after games, but occasionally a player will ask for help in the dugout. It helps you deal with a lot of the stressors in the game, the travel and the outside stuff through the season, says Diamondbacks outfielder Jock Peterson, who was helped by Martin the last two seasons with the Giants. As for what Martin stresses, it varies by player, but two points he hits hard, and these apply to everyone, are breathing horizontally, not vertically, meaning to use the diaphragm and breathing in through the nose and not the mouth. The nose humidifies the air and delivers more oxygenated air to the lungs. This is definitely not how I envisioned myself making it to the big leagues, says Martin with a laugh. But it is the big leagues, and his yips are gone. He's a regular catch partner for players, and he'll throw the occasional bullpen. My experience with anxiety and my love of the game just connected and really put me into a rabbit hole of curiosity that I'm grateful I explored. It's just interesting how life works out like that. This is the Magazine Rec on Chris. Finally, we have a piece by Dan Gartland titled, Charles Barkley Disses Losers Who Watched the Solar Eclipse. While thousands of people traveled to see a once-in-a-lifetime solar eclipse in many parts of the United States this past Monday, Charles Barkley was only interested in seeing a different rare conversion of two enormous objects, the battle between Purdue's 7'4" star Zach Edey and UConn's 7'2" Donovan Clingan. During halftime of Monday's national championship game between the Boilermakers and the Huskies, the conversation turned briefly to the eclipse that occurred over much of the country earlier in the day. Barkley immediately dismissed the phenomenon as being for losers. "Were you all some of the losers standing outside watching that today?" said Barkley. Ernie Johnson was quick to push back, though. "They're not losers," said Johnson incredibly. "They're not losers," said Johnson incredulously. "Yes, they are," Barkley shot back. "Hey, we've all seen darkness before. Stop it." "Come on, Chuckster, don't hate the eclipse," replied Johnson. The eclipse might not have been as dramatic in Phoenix, where the game was being played, as it was in other parts of the country, but Barkley still missed out on something pretty spectacular. While cities like Dallas, Little Rock, Indianapolis, Cleveland, and Buffalo were briefly plunged into darkness in the middle of the afternoon as the moon completely obscured the sun, the eclipse peaked with only 70% of the sun being covered. Even still, seeing the sun reduced to a crescent shape is a memorable experience, and Barkley really missed out. And that'll do it for this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the April 2024 issue of Sports Illustrated magazine and from the Sports Illustrated website, si.com. I'm Mario Cajar. So long till next time.